Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome to the Salieri Report someone who I've read for years. His name is Charles Hugh Smith. He has a wonderful blog called Of Two Minds, and is published not only there, but is republished elsewhere. He's widely. Among the financial world, he's a very popular blog in the on the internet, and he one of the reasons I love Charles' work is that he looks at a very wide range of stuff and tries to integrate it from the biggest aspects of global geopolitics and finance down to the most intimate level. He looks at who, the questions of who, so who's doing this globally and who's doing it in your household or what it is. So there's nothing he's not trying to integrate. The quote I use from him in today's or the blog post for today's interview was, we have to solve our own problems. And I really appreciate his efforts to bring everything back to me, my family, my community. What do I do? What's the action? Because that's what I control. That's what I have the ability to work with. So I see him as someone very much focused on identifying and increasing how we individually and collectively gather power. So, Charles Smith, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I'm honored to be here.
Well, I have to ask you, how did you come to be such a famous blogger on the internet? I'm sure you never, during in grade school, you never said, I'm going to grow up to be a famous internet blogger.
Well, I don't know about the famous part, but it is an enduring mystery to me as well. And I think the only answer I've come up with is it's the power of the distributed media that the internet has enabled. And it's enabled voices that would otherwise be completely marginalized, like my own and many others, to enter, if not the mainstream, then at least a free distribution system. And so it's exciting in the sense that anybody that was outside of the mainstream was really marginalized before the internet. And now those of us have entered the Darwinian world where the value of your work is able to come through. And that's how people decide whether to give you their time or not, is do they find value in your work? And if they do, then they show up to your site. And so in that sense, it's a kind of a meritocracy, if you will, which is refreshing in a system in which, you know, meritocracy has been replaced with cronyism.
Well, I call it, you know, some people call it the long tail. So we are able to create a business. So, for example, you've created a publishing business. I think you publish most of your own books. Is that not correct? And so you've been able to create a publishing business with a market and develop a following out here on the long tail. So bravo. We're going to talk about that more later on in the interview. So the thing that finally got me to sit down and say, we've just got to get Smith on the Salieri Report, was your recent blog on the Ukraine, and or one of them, and where you quote one of your many readers as saying, describing soft weapons. And I was intrigued by it because I think I have felt a great deal of frustration over the last decade and a great deal of sort of divide between me and many of the financial commentators because of the importance I see of soft weapons playing a role in managing the economy and determining what happens geopolitically. So I said, okay. Let's, you know, this is a great place to bring up the topic of soft weapons and the role of soft weapons in sort of permitting a much greater sort of centralized management of the economy. So tell me, in no means do I expect you to be an expert on soft weapons, you not having spent your lifetime in covert operations, but tell us your impression of soft weapons and why you brought up this discussion in the context of the Ukraine.
Okay, well, I think it's an excellent question, and it's one that's really under covered in the media, not, of course, not just the mainstream media, but even in the blogosphere, because I think few people have direct experience of it, which I know you do in spades, and I had my own little brush with sort of the COINTELPRO, which was the late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, really?
FBI sort of infiltration of the anti-war movement. And so, yeah, and so I here's how I approach the topic. I see soft weapons being used in three different sort of general areas of the economy. One, at the top level, we might call the geopolitical level, then the powers that be or the deep state, you know, there's various terms we use. That power structure uses soft weapons against other nation states, against alliances, suppliers of commodities. You know, there's a variety of targets and a variety of techniques. And we're seeing, I think we're going to see multiple levels of that in the Ukraine and perhaps in East Europe in general. And we can talk more about that. The second level is, of course, the soft weapons used against domestic political opponents or targets, which I think is what you experienced. And I had a little taste of it when the FBI called me up at home when I was 19 years old. And I was a draft counselor at the time in 1972, the year before the draft ended, and they did the usual, you know, it was kind of a comical thing, like they must have watched a lot of TV or something, because it was like, well, we know where you live, and, you know, that kind of primitive soft weaponry by today's standards, but still, it's effective when you get called by some powerful agency threatening you with 5 years in prison and all that stuff. So there's that level of soft weaponry, which includes intimidation, like what I experienced on a small level. And then there's, of course, phony accusations and infiltrating your group. And the infiltrator will do things like suggest a violent action so the state can then totally destroy you. You know, so there's lots of levels of that soft weaponry that that can be used against domestic. And then the third level is, I think, the soft weaponry used against marginalized populations. And I think one example of that domestically here in the States we're seeing is the rise of debt prisons, if you will, in the sense that you get a ticket and a speed trap and you forgot to pay the fine or didn't have the money because the fine is hundreds of dollars. And then you enter this Orwellian world where your parole is being handled by a private company, which has its own fees. And then when you fail to pay that or can't muster the hundreds of dollars to get out of that, then you end up in jail. So I kind of consider that as a level of soft weaponry, because it's not like stormtroopers coming in and arresting you, you know, and per se, but you end up caught up in a system that punishes and represses the marginalized.
Right, and that's why creating such a complex legal and regulatory structure is so powerful, because you can, if you divide the world into two classes, one that doesn't have to comply with all the rules and the other that does, you can always bollocks up and control the second with the mind-boggling complexity, because it's impossible, or it's near impossible, to be perfect.
That's right. And of course, there's a huge information asymmetry between us and them. And of course, that's one of the things I always look for, is who has access to the information and who's denied access to the information. And so for most of us, the legal code is impenetrable, and hiring an attorney is, you know, very expensive and out of our financial reach for most people. So we really have very almost no information about how the legal system works and what we're being charged with. Or the other the powers that be, of course, have all the information and the means to use it.
I would add another category to soft weapons, and that's essentially economic intelligence and insider trading.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, you've got a huge machinery sucking up information and then using that information to either optimize what you're making from each individual or business, but then also using that information to slow them down or compete. There's been a great series of articles in the last week or two about Yelp, which is a website that, among other things, provides reviews of local business, and the extent to which there are many allegations, it appears, from small business that it's really an extortion racket, and if they don't advertise with Yelp, then they start getting these phony baloney false reviews, or there's complaints when Yelp made a deal with Yahoo that the positive reviews disappeared. And the question I have, of course, is if this is true, how could it be so? How could a business like that get that much air cover? Well, if you look at all the publicly traded stocks that have local restaurants or local chains, you know, local locations, and are trying to move in and compete with a small business, you know, that's where your air cover is likely to come from. So you see a lot of this, there's a whole sort of category of soft weapon. And I think one of the challenges of describing this, if you and I were going to sit down and flesh out and say, okay, we're going to build a Wikipedia on soft weapons, it would end up being thousands of pages long. Because the number of, you know, I always tell people it's like the joy of cooking. There are thousands and thousands of recipes. And the machinery behind it has been growing for decades as the digital technologies have become more and more sort of ubiquitous and invasive. So this is a big topic.
Yes, and I'm fascinated with your example of Yelp, because this is a very subtle form, and it's privately held, and it impacts the small businesses, all of whom are desperate to kind of level the playing field, because they don't have the advertising budgets and billions of dollars. And so Yelp offers a platform, at least superficially, that that gives them a chance to use, you know, customer reviews to kind of level the playing field against corporate America. And so to find that, you know, that's been gamed, or it makes you extremely cynical about the system. But, you know, I'd like to throw out another thing, that another topic of soft weapons on this economic insider trading that you mentioned. I'm curious if you see the same sort of division I do, say, between like high frequency trading, which is a systemic skimming operation that's invisible to everybody. Again, information asymmetry on a systemic level. And then there's another kind of classification of that kind of manipulation of by insiders, which is sort of the Jesse Livermore school, where a handful of deep pockets goes in and either buys or sells something to beat it up, or create a trading trend and then manipulate the market simply with buying and selling in the open market. So it's interesting that there's, even if you don't have systemic control, like even if you're not a high-frequency trading firm skimming billions a year, you if you have enough money, you can manipulate the system without even having control of the server.
Well, in theory, yes, but where I see the big money is where the private guys determine a general direction, and then the central bank and the treasuries, you know, this is basically G7, agree that they're going to make it go there, so the bureaucracy gets on board. And so then you have a primary trend and direction, and you know it, others don't necessarily know it. There's a sort of a wide variation of how tight the circle is that gets this information. And then you align with that primary trend and sort of coordinate back and forth. And you've got the federal credits, you know, the governmental credits to back you up. And to me, that's where the really big, deep insider trading or insider intelligence, because it's not just trading, it's in the long term investments where you buy cheap. So to me, that's where the huge the big money is made. It's on, you know, sort of that identification, management, creation of the primary trend and the feedback loop. So for example, if you look at the yen carry trade for many for many years that the hedge funds were playing, you know, if I'm a hedge fund and I'm assured that here's how interest rates are going to go, you know, and I can borrow at 0% and invest at something more, you know, it's the same as the federal credit arbitrage that the banks were running. So it's a machine that simply prints a cash balance, and then I can use those profits to invest. So it's building my retained earnings in a rigged game. And then I use that rigged game as long, you know, what I have to do is I have to put the money where I'm told to put the money. I have to invest in, you know, what the machinery says it wants the investments invested in. So
I think that's an excellent summary.
Right. And one of the reasons, wouldn't surprise me, one of the reasons, you know, the focus is now on high frequency trading. It's a little bit like the limited hangout. You know, here's something you can identify. We can cancel it, and it can reaffirm the credibility of the system. But you know, the bigger, longer, deeper game. Another example of a great modified hangout. You have a number of commentators sort of running around the internet talking about the options trading on 9/11. In the airline stocks, and whatever that was, it was, you know, less than 1% of 1% of the insider trading and the money made on that operation. So all the big, you know, sort of the real big action would have been in the long bond market, the currency market and the related derivatives. So, and probably some in the mortgage market, but the big, deep, long fixed income. So the notion that they've got everybody talking about the options on the airline stocks, you know, is kind of, you know, but it's a way of satisfying the, satisfying the body politic. When I was in the Bush administration, they used to always try and satisfy everybody by, you know, getting somebody on their luncheon, you know, their luncheon with a home builder for $37.95. On the theory that that's what everybody could relate to.
Right. And I think this ties in very well with something you've discussed at length previously, which is setting up a front. And so I see what you're saying, that the whole high frequency trading thing is just another front, like, oh, see, we're really, you know, managing the system, and it's really open and transparent, you know, now that we've fixed it, you know. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that the major trend has allowed the big money, and of course the currency carry trades are an excellent example of that. And as you say, playing against a reduction in interest rates, borrowing at zero, that's where the really big money has been made.
How, as you've watched the economy, where have you seen the soft weapons make the most significant difference? Where have you noticed this? Where have you bumped into it? Where does it come up for you?
I think one area that I see it on at least the geopolitical level that has, of course, a domestic impact is energy, energy flows. And say, for instance, one example would be looking at the way that Saudi Arabia and the U.S. Suppressed the price of oil in the late 80s, and that certainly contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was even then dependent on somewhat dependent on oil revenues for hard money. So that's one level it's at the international level, but it has a huge impact domestically, of course, in terms of the price of oil and the knock-on effects of that. And it's something I've been kind of thinking about in terms of the Ukraine, and that I wonder if the supposed rift between Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and the U.S. that got some mainstream coverage, if that's another front, and that longer term soft weapon is to lower the price of oil such that it puts a pressure on Russia. Right. I don't know if that makes any sense within this.
Oh, tremendous sense. We've had Jim Norman on, author of the oil card, on the Soleri Report more than a few times, and Jim's thesis is that we ran up the oil price to bust the Soviet Union coming into 89, and then we have tried to, we are now running it back up to try and sort of checkmate the Chinese. And, you know, what's interesting is if you look at what's been going on with the Chinese since Russia, you know, the tension with Putin has grown, we seem to be, you know, trying to soften up and improve relationships with the Chinese. So there's there's clearly a dance going on there around energy, because if you bring the energy price down, of course, Russia is going to, that puts Russia in a very bad place.
And our other friends in Iran and Venezuela will also be, negatively impacted.
One of the things I wonder, watching what is happening in the Ukraine and the extent to which the United States is trying to use soft weapons to target individual people, decision makers in Russia. In my experience in the United States, I have rarely seen a population of people who could stand against soft weapons. And part of that was because they couldn't fathom that they existed. We've done a lot of Soleri reports on things like entrainment technology, mind control, different component parts of soft weapons to try and help people understand that these things exist. But nothing has been as effective as the Edward Snowden revelations, because you have somebody who was on the inside of the telecom infrastructure saying, you know, oh, here's how it works, and dumping out lots of documents over a long period of time. And, you know, he's sort of young, attractive, interesting, and for some reason, somebody somewhere is promoting him. So that's given the world, I think, a lot more of an education on what soft weapons are like. And, you know, step one is understanding that these things exist and how they work and the extent to which they can work by machine and artificial intelligence. Because I think a lot of people think that it's limited to a COINTELPRO kind of operation, and they don't understand, no, you can do this. You know, you can target billions of people with the right telecommunications. So I think one thing is knowing that it exists, but then the second thing is, you know, can a population build immunity, and how? And, you know, you almost think like Putin and his team, if they can't do it, how can anybody else do it?
Right. And of course, the Ukraine is an interesting and to some degree difficult to fathom, state and situation, because there are a lot of players. And those of us who are not experts in the area, I mean, I have one correspondent, an American expat who lives in Ukraine and has lived there for many years, that I kind of rely on for an on-the-ground report. But, of course, it's hard to sort out what people in Ukraine are seeing. But right. We have to remember that Russia, of course, has a large and well-established deep state as well,
right.
And, you know, and so there's an agenda that we can only guess about from their side. I think it's very interesting what you're saying about the sort of individual sort of spy versus spy COINTELPRO approach, which is to and there's a lot of tricks there that to undermine an individual with blackening their name in the media, sexual seduction, using that as a weapon. There's a whole range of that kind of targeting of an individual or a group. But when you're talking about,
which is very expensive and time consuming.
Yes. And so, but if you're manipulating a population, as you say, to my mind, it brings up the question, why are Americans so passive in the face of all the things that are happening. And I think that maybe it's a superficial answer, but to me, the first thing that comes to mind is they're afraid. And so then you go, well, what are they afraid of, and how did they become afraid? And then to me, that opens the discussion. What kind of soft weapons have created an atmosphere of fear in the entire populace?
Oh, but I think it's much deeper than fear, because if you look at the soft weapons, I think for many decades, starting with COINTELPRO, but then as the telecommunication system became more efficient and could do more by low-cost means, I think you're looking at a population that's been targeted by significant soft weapons for decades, everybody. So the entrainment technology, the mind control has been, you know, the programming, the influence, it's all been there for a long time. And I've studied the things that have happened to people. You know, when I first got in my Enemy of the State period, I said, okay, who else has lived through this? And, you know, who won and who lost and, you know, who made it and who, why? You know, I'll just go back and study best practices. And what I discovered is, to my amazement, you know, I think millions of people have been murdered, poisoned, killed, destroyed. You know, I think the soft weapon machinery in this country has harmed and hurt far more people than we would ever imagine. And in fact, you'll go back, you know, through a family's history, and they will not even realize what happened to them. You know, they just think it's rotten luck. And so I think the control, you know, to me, controlling Americans invisibly and fiddling with them is the biggest job program in the country. You know, and that was all before the 90s, when we started literally just dropping SWAT teams into neighborhoods and rounding up innocent people and putting them in the equivalent of slave labor camps. So I think Americans are afraid, but I think one of the reasons they're afraid is the enemy is invisible. It's hard to see who's really doing this and what's effective. So I know many Americans who I think are very courageous, but they don't, you know, their question, and it's one of the reasons I come back and I love your work, their question is, okay, what's the action? What can I do to navigate this that, you know, takes care of my fiduciary obligation to me and my family, but also contributes to a real solution? You know, everybody intuitively understands we can't get out of this alone. We got to get out of this together. So we have to find a way to collaborate. And the question is, how? Because I just wrote a commentary on the blog called The Touch, and it was about, you know, the extent to which you start to see something develop that's positive in a community or in a different group or organization, and then suddenly they start getting worked over by the soft weapons and it falls apart. It's happened to me literally hundreds of times. And you know, and it's about why does it happen so easily? So I think Americans are kind of looking for effective action and feel stumped about it.
Yes, and that's a fascinating topic on several levels, I think, Catherine. I'll start my response by referring to the 1967 book, which made a bit of a splash at the time, The Politics of Experience by the psychiatrist R.D. Lang. And what the book is really about is how our experience of the world is shaped. And if in the context of our discussion of soft weaponry, you can say the ultimate soft weapon is shaping someone's experience so that they experience an event in the way that you want them to experience it, so that it's totally internalized. And I think that at the lowest level of our the soft weapons we're discussing, that's really the ultimate weapon is to control or influence our experience of the world so that we experience it like we're being told to, and then we experience it as our own internal experience, and we're not even aware that we've been shaped. And so I think that what can we do? What's our personal response? Well, I think the first thing is to recapture our own experience of the world. And number one is to be aware of the way that our experience is being shaped by the media and the socialization we went through in grade school. And, you know, there's a lot of different components to that
that shaping of our experience. And so we have to like take control of our own experience. And that, to me, that starts with like limiting your exposure to the mind, you know, the mind control parts of the system, which is, you know, the mainstream media and the digital media in general, is to not allow ourselves to become deranged by just overexposure to information. And
go hug a tree.
Yeah, kind of like just realize that our experience starts out with if we sort of need to re-authenticate our experience, and that allows us to kind of wall off how much of ourselves is exposed to that. And then, of course, the second topic that you bring up is forming community. And it's long been my thesis that the rise of the central state has really crippled our ability to form communities. We've sort of lost the cultural tools to form community. And guys like Christopher Lash and a variety of other commentators have talked about the terrible like loneliness and isolation that's now the default setting for Americans.
Well, it's very isolating. I have to tell you my story of the Victor the Cleaner smile. There's a wonderful scene in La Femme Nikita where, have you ever seen La Femme Nikita?
It was
called The Point of No Return. Anyway, Nikita is an assassin in a situation with two other operators that's gone wrong, two or one. And they have to call in what's called the cleaner, who's the person who comes in and sort of surveys the situation, you know, and sort of offs everybody who needs to be off, and is always a very dangerous character. And the cleaner is played in the American version by Harvey Keitel, and he's, he's very scary. So he comes in and kills the first operative and turns to Nikita, and she looks at him with a very chipper smile, and she says, "How can I help?" To prove that she's completely, you know, coherent and on board to be as useful as possible. And so he doesn't try and offer till later, at which point she escapes. Anyway, during the bailouts, I was sitting, I was at the gym, and it's the only time I ever watch television. I kind of scan the channels, and we had about 8 TVs up all on the financial news, and I was listening to music on an iPod, but sort of looking at the ticker tapes come across. And everybody had the same smile on it. And I said, you know, I've seen that smile before. Where have I seen that smile? And I said, oh, it's the Victor the Cleaner smile. And the Victor the Cleaner smile is what you get when something is terribly frightening. And you say to everybody, how are you? And they say, fine, we're fine. How are you? We're fine. So a lot of what I see in America is people saying that everything's fine. But at some level, whether conscious or unconscious, they know it's not. They just are trying to get along, you know, sort of within target range of Victor the Cleaner.
Yes. And then what we have is a system which is, of course, leaning more and more on the productive workers that are left to generate, you know, more work and more value. And so then for those people that do have jobs in corporate America or even government, more is expected of them, and there's less left of their life for themselves. And so it's sort of the Red Queen running in place. And that's the what I see amongst my cohort of people with jobs, is everybody's just running as fast as they can to stay in place. And so it's really hard to get off of that that machine. And of course, that's why many of us look to the alternative economy, what I call the community economy, or what other people call the emerging economy, this sort of part of the economy that's enabled by the internet and by connecting local communities, and that ties into a very powerful system. And you know, in systems analysis, we say you can't change the system without adding a feedback loop. And so, the internet allows a whole nother feedback loop into communities, so that if somebody's got a good idea now in some place thousands of miles away from me, I can access that good idea, copy it, you know, communicate with him.
Right.
And so it's a very disruptive feedback loop that's positive, I think. And of course, everyone's trying to control.
Let me tell you a little secret. If you were to draw a circle around an ecosystem, let's say in America it's a county, the current financial wealth is 1% of what it could be if things were optimized. And the key to me of, you know, and when I say financial wealth, I just mean, doesn't mean we have to trade it or treat it as financial wealth, but the, you know, the poverty that exists is, you know, is created by not allowing the system to optimize. So, but the key to getting it from 1 to 100% is you've got to back off the small weapons. You've got to find a way to build your immunity system against the soft weapons. So what you're onto is very powerful. And I, for one, believe the soft weapons can, you know, we can build our immune system to it. You know, if you look at where people have succeeded in sort of backing up the system, you know, two examples I use are gun control, another is homeschooling. You know, but we can't back it up without talking about it, which is why I'm so appreciative that you are willing to do so today, because not a lot, you know, not everybody's willing to confront this issue.
Yeah, Catherine, and it's interesting how people find inspiration from relatively small things. In other words, I think the typical American is starved for authenticity, honesty, and a positive alternative. In other words, people want these, but
yeah.
They don't know what that means. And so a lot of times I just start out with, you know, one of my favorite, you know, lines of my own is, you know, a home garden and home cooked meal are revolutionary acts. And the reason why I say that is, it's like taking control of your own authenticity, you know, that you're, you know, your own integrity, like you're going to eat a real food meal you prepared with somebody else in your household and have an experience that can't be commoditized by some corporation. You've taken back a really important part of your life. And that's, I think, part of the immunity to soft weapons is minimizing our exposure to the media, which is, of course, the channel for the, you know, the soft weaponry, but also just recovering that sense of agency, if you will. And a lot of people have lost that sense of agency because they've been conned into, gosh, it's cheaper for me to go to the all-you-can-eat buffet than to buy food and make a real meal. But, of course, it's not the same. You know, one is a commodity controlled by a corporation. The other one is in your control.
So you have a new book that I was delighted to see. I didn't know until this morning that you had a new one published. So it's on a topic very near and dear to my heart. So before we close, I would love to cover the new book and talk a little bit about it.
Great, Catherine. It's sort of the result of me integrating my own marginalized 40 years of work. And I've had a lot of different jobs and started businesses and now have some experience in what you might call an internet-related business or the emerging economy, whatever. And so I wanted to sort of integrate that with what I've learned about the way the economy works. So that's the book is the result of that union of looking at how the economy works and what opportunities are still left there, and taking my own experience as a beginner, as someone who's been out of work, someone who started a business, who's found a job, and putting those together.
So tell us the name and tell us about what it's about.
Okay, the title is Get a Job, Build a Real Career, and Defy a Bewildering Economy. And those of us who know a lot about the economy, we understand it's bewildering because it's undergoing a lot of changes, some of which are controlled and some of which are the result of destabilizing systems, which is, say, the technology, and which is throwing a wrench in a lot of systems that people assumed were stable. And so we have to deal with an unstable situation as individuals. And my basic idea is you can't rely on an institution to accredit your ability as a human being. And you can't really count on an institution to accredit your integrity, which is something that's often overlooked as in terms of value, what I would call part of our human capital. And so the thrust of my book is we can take charge of accrediting ourselves and take it away from institutions. You know, we can accredit ourselves and use the internet as a way of doing that. And that will help us get a job and build, you know, positive collaborative communities.
One of the, I think one of the challenges of doing that, it all comes down to the mathematics of time. And if you look at a person's time, they can pursue credentials in the centralized system, which can be very expensive and not successful. And part of the key to having the time to build skills and to build a brand independently is to swing that time over to things which are effective. So instead of getting $200,000 of student loans to study something that it turns out is not economically relevant in the world that we're going into, instead use that money, you know, invest your parents' money or invest the money you made, or, you know, don't take out the student loan and invest that time in things that build highly specific skills that are really useful in the economy that we're going into. And so it gets back to this thing about not getting tricked and suckered into spending your time on something that works for the centralized systems, but not for you.
I think that's a brilliant summary of what I was trying to say. And because what we really have is we have to invest in ourselves. In other words, if we had to summarize, what can we do as individuals in this gamed system? We would say invest in yourself and ask yourself, to whose benefit? You know, who's going to benefit from that $200,000 invested in a essentially useless credential? And of course, it's not the individual, although that's what they're sold. So, I think another sort of subject that I think is underexplored is the value of having a variety of skills, and that's another thing that seems to have been eroded by our economy's focus on specialization and getting a degree that, you know, in casino management or something. And we seem to have lost the bedrock of human capital, which is a variety of life skills. And if I'm going to hire somebody, I don't really care what their degree is. And I think a lot of people in the economy are starting to feel this way. What I want to know is that they have personal integrity. And, you know, that they're honest and that they are forthright and they'll do what they say, and that they have a variety of skills, because it turns out in the real world, having a variety of skills sort of cross-pollinates. You learn.
Right.
And so that's how we solve problems. And really, when we come down to what are we doing at work? You know, what is work? Well, it's creating value to other people and it's solving problems. And so that's,
it's being useful. It's being of service.
Yes, and so I'm excited about the opportunities we have to build small businesses, enterprises, and communities that are outside the mainstream, but sort of running in parallel to them. You know, we're still going to use the grid and the highways on occasion, but, you know, we're not like going to completely be cut off, but we're going to fly under the radar, and we're going to establish, you know, positive things kind of beneath this, beneath the radar, where we're not going to threaten the powers that be and call upon the, you know, the B-52s of soft weapons on ourselves. But but we're going to create a positive life in a very sick, inauthentic world.
Well, it's kind of like a body with cancer. Every cell that you know, turns healthy adds to the chances of all the cells to turn healthy. Okay, so let me ask you the toughest question, because just looking at you and all you do from afar, you seem to have figured this out, and it's one of the ones I struggle with. So I'm going to ask you, because hopefully there's some insight here that can help me. When you deal in this environment, what I see in any place I go, any community, any area of the world, there are people who never lack for income. They're unbelievably hardworking. They love to learn. They're helpful. They have good habits. And the thing that's amazing is they maintain good habits despite the fact that they are constantly watching a system that can hiccup and mess them up. And you will see in many areas that have, you know, the black neighborhoods used to call it the beatdown, who've been worked over by soft weapons or hard weapons or both, people kind of give up. They develop a bad attitude. They get cranky. They develop bad habits. And they fall out of that mode, which makes for successful entrepreneurship. And so one of the things I've wondered about is how can I maintain great habits and a positive attitude, you know, in a world where these, you know, things are so ridiculously unfair and complex. And a lot of it comes back for me in understanding who you can and cannot trust and limiting your interaction with those you can align with in a trustworthy way during this period. But to me, you seem to be someone who's maintained a very positive attitude. You keep working and producing. You clearly are very organized. You have great habits, is my theory from watching, just watching you from afar. How do you do it? How do you maintain that kind of excellence in the face of something, you know, full of such entropy and clearly very morbid?
I think it goes back to what you said just now about finding trustworthy people. And I think that all of us need a circle of other positive people. In other words, people who are outside the matrix. And that studies have found, say, that when people are tackling a very difficult thing like alcoholism or losing weight, things that are just really difficult, it turns out that nothing can replace a group. You know, that it's like being with a group of people who see the same thing and are dealing with the same issues. That seems to be what we as humans need to kind of keep with the program or advance our own growth. And so I think that, again, this isolation and atomization that we get, that's what causes a lot of us to become negative, you know, is we feel so alone. And of course, that's a great control to atomize people. So try to find a group of people who are like-minded and will encourage you to grow as a human being. I think that's my first strategy.
Right. And it's a good one. It's a good one, particularly if they can develop an understanding and immunity to the soft weapons.
Yeah, and I use these words that sound, they just don't fit into the mainstream. Nobody talks about integrity and authenticity, but I think that that's really the core, is that if you feel like you're being yourself, then
right.
It gives you the resilience, and that requires some practice and self knowledge, and of course we all have some reservoir of willpower, and the academic studies show that it's not unlimited, and so we have to sort of invest our willpower in as we do with our finances and our time. We have to invest that willpower in ourselves So that's the other trick I use. I just constantly try to invest in myself and people I care about, and I try to limit or minimize the amount of money and time I spend supporting, you know, the matrix.
Well, I think that's excellent advice. I know people will sometimes say, look at somebody who's still operating within the matrix and say, don't you wish you were back there with them? And I'm like, oh, no. We once had an energetic healer. There's a wonderful energetic healer on our team, and I once said to her, you know, I sat down and calculated, if instead of trying to sort of save the world, I instead had spent my money. This is because I lost so much on it. I was trying to do community venture funds and bring transparency to government money by place. Anyway, so I ran into the buzzsaw. Anyway, so I said, instead of trying to do community venture funds, if I'd just taken my money and invested it in what I thought was going to go up in value, I'd be worth $39 million today. And she said, yes, but you'd be dead. And I said, you know, you're right, because living, you know, I'm not somebody who does well at living an inauthentic life. And I realized I would be dead. I literally physically could not have tolerated the, you know, sort of the life and the sort of insanity of the situation. Anyway, well, Charles, it's been a privilege having you on the Salieri Report. Could you describe your website and your books, how we find you, how we stay up with your work, how we buy your books and continue to support your work?
Please visit me at oftwominds.com, and all the links there to my books and the blog are right there on the site. And Catherine, I want to say that I really admire your work, not just in elucidating very difficult concepts and structures, but in the community building that you've attempted to do and that you promote. And that's really the future. And so I have just great admiration for you and your work.
Well, I keep trying. I'm willing to succeed. I'm willing to succeed. I do feel though that I've been perpetually bested on the soft weapon issue, which is why I wanted to talk about it and talk about it with somebody who understood the absolute importance of taking action at the individual and small group and community level. That's the building block. So I always say, you know, the planet is the body and the community is the molecule. And unless the molecules are healthy, you know where that goes. So anyway, so we're willing for it to work. Anyway, Charles, in that spirit, again, thank you for being on the Salieri Report. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much, Catherine.